Senate Environment, Energy, and Natural Resources Budget Division will come to order. Senator Rosen is here. Let's take you first.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members.
Good morning.
It's very nice to be in front of your committee, Madam Chair. I haven't been in front of here this year, but Senate File 2268 deals with the Blue Earth River State Water Trails designation and appropriation. And back in 1983, the DNR released a report titled The Statewide Outstanding Rivers Inventory, and there is a handout, Madam Chair, that you should have that looks pretty old and outdated from 1983, but it also says it lists the 10 streams and rivers as having the first priority for detailed study and plan development. And of those 10 that are listed, the Blue Earth River is the only stream which has not been designated, and what was known as a canoe route has now been classified as a water trail. Madam Chair, this was brought to me by a constituent, but I happen to be a very big kayaker, and I'm sure there's quite a few. Well, Senator Chaudhry is a big kayaker. He's got some. And so this is a big deal down in our area to have this river designated as a water trail. Currently, there are 29 streams that are classified as water trails located all around the state, and the Blue Earth River would become the 30th. There was an amendment that was put on the Environment Policy Committee to update the language from canoe route to the state water trail that was set by the DNR. And as I said, kayaking is one of the fastest growing recreational sports, and new water trails is a name that reflects that. So that's what with the DNR, and there is also a handout about that too. With me, I have Ron Potter from the DNR, Natural Resources Program Manager. And he'll talk about the fact that there's no general fund dollars that will be needed for this designation. The DNR's Water Recreational Fund is funded by canoe and boat license fees and is dedicated for water recreation. So if this bill passes, a portion of those dedicated funds will be used for this designation.
All right. Thank you, Senator Rosen. Mr. Potter?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen's bill is very similar to what we have in our policy bill. As she mentioned, we did propose adding this river to the canoe and boating route system, and we also proposed the name change to state water trails. The only difference is the funding. It's not part of the governor's budget proposal, so that part is not in our bill.
And Madam Chair. Madam Chair, it's about $60,000 that would be designated for that. It says that, clearly states that on the bill.
But we save that money from going into the general fund in our budget, so there's more money left. At least we hope we have. When the conference committee's done, we'll find out. Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, a couple years ago, Senator Dill added a branch of the Crow River, I believe it was, to this list, and we also added the Redwood River. I think this is a good designation. They provide canoe and kayak accesses, sometimes campgrounds. So I'd like to move that Senate File 2268 be, you want this to go as a separate bill or to be part of the omnibus bill?
Senator Fredrickson, we would put this in the omnibus bill.
I would move then that we lay Senate File 2268 on the table and that we recommend putting it into the omnibus bill.
Right. On the, go ahead, Senator Dill, on the motion.
Madam Chair, I know Senator Fredrickson knows the answer to this, but now the $60,000 listed in the appropriation, would the intent be that that would go in terms of the DNR 5-day? When you and I had our rear report,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill, by my memory, it was $60,000 each.
So this is just, okay, let's clarify that. I thought this was for the whole program, or is this just for the new trail?
Madam Chair, this would be just for that trail. Yes, for the Blue Earth River. And it clearly states this is a one-time appropriation and available until spent. And believe it or not, we do have tourism down in southern Minnesota, and we are actively working at promoting the beautiful areas that we have, and this would be one of them. I plan on using it.
And all the other river trails that are listed, are the water trails, I should say?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, they're all rivers. Are they already covered with adequate signs?
Yes, Madam Chair. I should have let Mr. Potter, but I believe this is the last one to be designated and worked on.
So we wouldn't be competing with anybody else's trail. Mr. Potter?
Madam Chair, that's correct. Yeah, the other ones have all been designated. They're mapped. They're signed. The other appropriations that were spoke about earlier, there's still some funding left in those as we wrap those up. But again, those were one-time appropriation to those rivers until spent.
Okay, very good. So, Senator Rosen, I think we want to do this on the condition that you invite us down to kayak there.
Madam Chair, I have sent that invitation out in Senator Chaudhry's, and I extend it to this committee, and then we will go to the Channel Inn, Madam Chair.
Very good. I'll look forward to the hamburgers. All right.
After we kayak. But after we kayak.
That's right. You want to save those extra few pounds for after you're done so you don't sink. All right. On the motion made by Senator Frederickson, any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
All right, Senator Scogin.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For you, Senate File 2864 is the annual lands bill. And 34 pages in length. We had a subcommittee on lands that held one evening of testimony, and then we had a day in the full environment committee as well with under Senator Chaudhry. And I can walk through it section by section. There's a lot of different pieces. I can have Kathy Lewis come to the table and explain some of it, or members.
Well, Senator Scogin,
how would you like to proceed with this?
If you can focus on the sections that you believe have any fiscal impact, that's what we really need to look at today. And so that's a little hard to, but the ones that involve sale of land or other fiscal impact.
I might need Kathy Lewis's help to pull those out quickly.
All right, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Kathy Lewis with Lands and Minerals Division, Department of Natural Resources. The first section that has a minor fiscal impact is Section 3 of the bill. This concerns the Heal Annex Mine State Park. I would say that we are in discussions with the Minnesota Historical Society at the moment, so this could change. What we brought this provision forward is that we believe there's a need to clarify legislation. There's a legislation that directs that school trust lands generate revenue, and this is school trust land. Heal Annex Mine State Park was created by statute that recognized the mining would be allowed, but Heal Annex Mine State Park is also a historic designation, and we would be required under current law to do a study, which would be about $20,000, to look at mitigation and preservation. And so what the provision in the law currently stands is asking for a waiver of the study requirement provided in law.
And Ms. Lewis, just tell us what would be the impact of not doing that study. I mean, what could happen in terms of not having a plan for preservation?
Madam Chair, members, what we're looking at this point in time is a large stockpile material that would be removed. It would generate about $9 million for the school trust fund. It is an area that's already been disturbed by mining. There are people at the park that provide historic interpretation. And so our DNR position is there's enough resources in place that we don't need to do a study because the study would look at mitigation, and we need to remove the stockpile to generate the revenue. But there'll be a new mining forum for interpretation at the park.
Okay, I think we'll hear from the Historical Society on that when we get through the bill.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Section 5 of the bill is from Senator Olson, and this concerns the requirement that state agencies sell $6.44 million worth of land by June 30th of 2011. The state is still needing $2.5 million to reach that requirement. The provision in the law says that if it's not met, the money comes out of state budgets. The provision that Senator Olson brought forth was that the DNR's contribution, which is $2.2 million at this point, is sufficient, and the DNR does not need to contribute any more toward that requirement.
And the cost, can you talk, Mr. Mueller, about what the cost of that would be then? We can have have you.
Yeah, two.
I think if you don't mind, we'll sort of do these section by section.
These are the first two that we've mentioned are two that had the most anxiety and our other stops as well, Madam Chair. So it's good to get the story on these.
I don't know. I've already. Why don't we just wait? Why don't we go through it? Because I'm already having the Historical Society wait. We'll go through the bill and then we'll bring you all along. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Section 6 of the bill was added by Senator Scoie, has a fiscal impact of about $42,000. We are, under current law, have a written offer out to the tribe at value for the Roy Lake Station property at $42,500, and this provision would require us to sell it for $1. Madam Chair, the next section, starting at Section 10, are sales of state-owned land. There's also quite a few bills that were added that were sale of tax forfeited land. There are, most of the sale parcels are modest value, 1,000 acres or less. We have not in most instances done appraisals yet, but there is one section, which is Section 12. That is the Cloquet Forestry Office. And that one is right in a prime area that is, when you come off Highway 35 and you're heading into town, it's right on your right, and the city has now come to the area, and it's a prime commercial development. And the local unit of government has approached us of whether the DNR would consider relocating its staff and moving its office and conveying the office property to the local community for marketing and packaging together for commercial development. And in our fiscal note, we've identified that that is going to be worth about $1 million. It would go to the facilities management account, and that would be used by the DNR to, under the law, for three options. One is to acquire a new building site, two is to repair existing buildings, or three, to buy a building. Otherwise, the land sale parcels are low value. And then the last section of the bill that has a fiscal impact is Section 42 of the bill. And this concerns a Lamprey Pass WMA. It concerns a federal-funded project to create a new overpass over 35 at Forest Lake. And as part of the process, they needed a piece of land, DNR land, and the Lamprey Pass WMA. We've granted an easement. Under existing law, the easement payment, which was $600,000, went into the Game and Fish Fund, and DNR is requesting to transfer that over to the land acquisition account so they can use it to purchase other land. And that's the basic fiscal impacts, Madam Chair.
Ms. Lewis, how many of, I'm just glancing through, Section 15 has language that allows the commissioner to sell the land for less than its value. Are there, how many times is that language in here?
Madam Chair, the Section 6, which was added by Senator Scoie, is in the bill for that provision. The one that you're referring to, on the Longville it's a Longville parcel. It's actually, Section 15 is one where it's actually school trust land. We're going to do a land exchange with acquired forestry land before we convey it to the school district that's been using it as a school forest. The Section 16 is a potential sale of a parcel on Woman Lake, and we've identified Leech Lake Watershed District as potential party. But in subsequent conversations since the session started, they have indicated they're not very likely interested, so it's more likely to be sold by public sale. Section 18 is a potential sale to a local unit of government for a stormwater runoff program. This is near the city of Rockford. So that's another one.
So on Section 16, if it's not sold to a public, to the watershed district or whatever you mentioned, the local government, then it would still be up for sale, but it would be required to meet the usual private sale requirements for appraised value?
Yes, Madam Chair. The public sale would be at full appraised value.
Madam Chair, I'll have an amendment to bring the city of Wayzata under the Scoie provision for a transfer of land for a dollar to when the time's appropriate. So,
Madam Chair, that's the end of the provisions. That would be direct sales for potential less than appraised value.
All right. Are there other questions?
Madam Chair.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Scogin, just on the Section 6 of the bill, in looking at it, the stricken language is the language that says less than the value of the land is determined by the commission and replaced with $1. What is the reason to sell the land for a dollar?
Well, in that particular case, there is an agreement also between, and Ms. Lewis may be able to help me with this, between the tribe and the city up there to allow the DNR, or between the DNR and the tribe, to allow them to continue to use that fire station as a as part of their fire control and fire prevention. So their Senator Skoy did some negotiations with them, and it has bounced everywhere from a dollar to, I think it's at 40.
It's at 26,000.
26,000. I mean, it's been all over the place, and Senator Skoy decided to just try to get it done, and this is the provision he brought to the committee.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair and Senator,
Senator
Skogan, I'd be willing to pay $2.
Would you be able to also man the fire station up there?
Senator Frederickson.
Through this, it would also have to be used for public purpose, so somebody tried to use it for private use. It would revert back to the state, I believe.
That's
that
correct,
right,
Senator Frederickson.
All right, Senator Skogan, you have an amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair, thank you. I'll move the A7.
You can't move it, but maybe
someone else
would be so kind as to.
I would look for someone to move the A7, I guess.
So moved, Madam Chair.
I'll take mine. Thanks. Oops, I took two. There you go.
Yep.
This is actually.
Senator Skogan.
This has been in play in our lands bill for a couple of years now, as the City of Wayzata, the Department of Natural Resources, and some people who are interested in doing some development down there began to wrangle about a piece of property that really is encumbered by sewer lines and I believe some other infrastructure. And Senator Olson believes that this is an appropriate way to resolve this, and she asked if we'd consider this amendment today.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Actually, the sale of this parcel was in the Senate bill last year all the way to conference committee at no consideration. It is, I asked to reintroduce it consistent with Senator Skoy's provision, because both of them were kind of caught in the same trap that relates to the other provision that you have to discuss on the required land sale with funds to the general fund. This is a scrap of land that is actually a dog leg that's 25 feet wide and 150 feet long that can only be used for a public purpose. The city has easements over it for the stormwater drainage. It was a remnant of a county ditch. And the provision that ended up in the conference committee was problematic. It's been problematic to me that we would have any language like it. Then I would like to see it come out that required another parcel of land to be acquired before that scrap could be transferred. And part of the reason for that is that it put the city and the negotiator in a very difficult position, in a disadvantaged position, to dealing with the property owner for a gas station that turned out to be owned by somebody, a partnership, that one of whom is probably going to be spending the rest of his life in prison. So I think we should be cleaned out of it. I won't name names at this point, but you probably figure it out. So that is the reason for that. It's consistent with Senator Skoy's position was that's another transfer between a governmental entity and they are planning to run the station and the fire station, and so the state would continue to be benefited from it. And so that was why he offered the amendment to just transfer it for a dollar and get it behind us. But the provision that when we deal with this, that I would like to help anybody that needs any more understanding of it on the land sale issue.
And what is, Senator Olson, what's the appraised value of this?
Well, that was the challenge. The DNR had it appraised for $400,000. For two-tenths of an acre, that's $2 million an acre for something that can't be used for anything. I mean, if they were talking about it being retail space, but if it was to be sold for anything else, it would revert to the state because it has to be for a public purpose. And there's no way a city that just had to cut $300,000 out of its budget can afford to pay $400,000 for a scrap of land. So this was a kind of behavior, and I don't want to blame DNR on it, but was driven by having to meet this land sale requirement that I'm trying to help resolve for DNR as well.
So if we sell this, if we authorize this sale for a dollar, does that mean that we can only count a dollar towards the DNR's obligation to sell land, or can we count 400,000? I don't think so, but that creates, these kind of giveaways do create a problem.
Well, Madam Chair, no. But the other provision, what's the section? The section two?
Section five.
Section five is the one that deals with that.
Yeah. So I know that's a separate issue, but we'll get to that in a minute. Mm-hmm. But we have several exceptions here, and so. I mean, I understand what you're trying to do and why, and it makes sense. It's that when we make all these exceptions and we're, basically giving away DNR land, it just makes it harder to meet those obligations that were set in law.
Well, Madam Chair, this was a scrap of a little piece of a county, remnant of a county ditch that the county wanted off its books and gave to the state a long time ago. And it is historically, I've been around here long enough and been on the committees dealing with land sales. We've done land transfers of this nature at no consideration for that's been the policy and the practice, but for somebody deciding that we're going to have land sale, a lump amount of money, land sale to close out the bottom line of a budget. Back in 2005, that is what has been driving a behavior that's changed a long-standing policy, and I think we should try to get back to it instead of putting the department in a position like this, as well as having this kind of a relationship with local units of government.
All right. Other discussion on the A7 amendment. Who moved it? Somebody did.
I did.
Senator Hand did. On the A7 amendment, any other discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
If that's all you have, Senator Scogin, why don't we bring up the other?
Yeah, why don't we go to Section 3, members? Thank you, Ms. Lewis. Appreciate that.
All right.
Lanx Mine.
Let's bring up the Historical Society, please.
Yes.
Mr. Fox.
Morning.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Fox. I'm Deputy Director for Programs at the Minnesota Historical Society. And I'm here to speak to Section 3 of the bill, as Ms. Lewis referred to. The Hill Annex Mine was created. There are really three objectives, as she pointed out, that are at play here. One is that this park was created in 1968 to document and provide the public an opportunity to understand the history of open pit mining in Minnesota. It's an important part of our economic and cultural heritage. The second goal was in that bill, it also recognized that there was a potential for future mining. And I want to say that the Historical Society's intent is not to delay or obstruct in any way the mining activity that's going on there. We understand that's in law. That's not the issue here. The third part is that a property like this, which has also been named by the federal government as being on the National Register of Historic Places, generates another statute, 138.665, which says where the state is taking an action that affects a National Register project, the state entity or its subdivision has to consult with the Historical Society on preserving the historical integrity of that spot. DNR has testified that they believe that those requirements are incompatible. It's simply our belief that they are not, that we can achieve all three of those goals without exempting DNR from the review provision, which is in the bill before you. Normally, we try to work this sort of thing out. We review 20 or 30 such review. We carry out 20 or 30 such reviews annually. And in the 17 years that this bill has been in place, we've never been in a situation where we have not been able to successfully negotiate an understanding with the state agency or entity that's involved. So there's not a history of difficulty here in that respect. The normal way we do this is with a memorandum of understanding or a programmatic agreement. We met last week with DNR. We proposed this as an option. They agreed to consider such a programmatic agreement, and we intend to provide them by the close of today a two-page programmatic agreement that would spell out how the two parties would move forward and resolve this issue without resorting to a policy statement in statute that creates an exemption to what is basically a standard environmental review. So I'm here just today to point out our concerns, to make you aware of the issue, and to update you on the status of these discussions. I'd be happy to answer any questions that the members might have.
Thank you, Mr. Fox. Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Fox, so are you saying that Section 3, if the memorandum you referenced is accepted, are you saying that Section 3 is not necessary to be in the bill?
Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson, yes, that would be our assumption. That would provide a way to achieve the goal that's intended in Section 3 without having to create that policy statement.
And
Senator Fredrickson.
I'm wondering if the Department of Natural Resources is in agreement with that.
Ms. Lewis. Welcome back. Ms. Lewis.
Madam Chair, Senator, the DNR would prefer that this Section 3 remain in the bill at this time. We have not yet seen the programmatic agreement, and we need to meet and discuss this issue with Minnesota Historical Society and see if we reach agreement until, and then if we do reach agreement, then it could be pulled from the bill.
Senator Fredrickson? Okay. I guess I would be inclined to say we should take this out of the bill, personally. I'm not sure. Obviously, the best result would be to work something out, and I think we'd all like to see that happen, but I'm not sure if we want to set a precedent of just creating exceptions to the historical review for without a really, really good reason why. And it's $20,000. It's not a really, really good reason why. Is that the only real reason? Or you just don't think it's necessary because it's removing tailing piles?
Madam Chair, members, the we don't have the $20,000. That's one reason. But the other reason is we think one is to resolve the conflict in statute to identify we don't need it is another reason. But the third reason is we have a mining company that's ready to mine. They're ready to go. We could be earning rental for the school trust fund right now and having payment coming in a year's time instead of sitting back and doing a study saying what's going to happen when you remove a stockpile. What happens when you remove a stockpile? You have the bare ground, and why do we need to do a study to do that? So we're questioning why the study is really needed, too.
Okay. Senator Rummel?
Madam Chair, but don't we typically do that kind of review before we?
That's what the law requires, so that's standard practice. So they're asking for an exemption from current law.
Madam Chair, I'm inclined to agree with you that we shouldn't be making exceptions at this point for such a small item.
Well, maybe what we should do, I mean, if you want to make a motion to delete it, we can vote on that. If this is in the omnibus bill, we'll be back on Friday reviewing it, and maybe by then we could have a conclusion one way or the other, whether the agreement has been successful.
Madam Chair.
Senator Fredrickson?
Why don't we let Senator Scogin continue to monitor this and see how the agreement's going, and we can revisit this at another stop as this bill proceeds along.
Well, we could do that on Friday as well. We could just see if they've made progress by Friday and just leave it be for two more days. I mean, that's really the next stop.
So I'd like to hear what Senator Scogin would like us to do.
Well, I would Scogin. Like to leave it in. We've heard it twice. It's mm-hmm. We've had this similar discussion. It stayed in. It's $20,000 to the DNR. As Ms. Lewis said, they don't have. It's $9 million to the school trust fund. It's an opportunity to take what at one time was a waste pile. I know it's in a historical site, but it's got some value, and this is an opportunity. It's a one-time exemption. I didn't think it was an unreasonable request. I understand the Historical Society has some anxiety about it, but, this... I'm willing to see what the DNR and the Historical Society come up with for an agreement, and if we have till Friday, we'll now they have a deadline, Thursday.
All right.
All right. Senator Saxhog.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I guess the emphasis here is we can't say it too much, is this is a pile of rocks that had and been piled there when they were mining the Hill Annex mine. It's not just a regular, this isn't just going to a taconite plant. This is a new a process that's going on up there where waste rock in tailings ponds and piles of rock are being reconstituted and the iron is being taken out of what used to be just a dump. So there's good reason here. I realize we have a process, but it would seem to me this would be a place for an exception. But that being said, I agree that we should let Senator Scogin monitor this, and as you say, Madam Chair, we're coming back as a bill. So I would hope we wouldn't take it out right now.
So the revenue from the sale of this material goes to the school trust fund because this is school trust land within the state park?
And this came off school trust land.
The tailings are from a school trust land. Okay. And so, all right. And I wonder, anybody know how much money it might bring in?
Approximately, Madam Chair, $9
million. Oh, that's real money. Senator Torres Ray, did you have your hand up? All right, well, why don't we just review this on Friday, and we'd like you to work it out by then.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And then let's go back to section 5.
This was the exemption, members and Madam Chair, of course, that carved the DNR out of selling lands to backfill the general fund, and they've kind of... Senator Olson kind of felt that they had done their work, and the administration is a little concerned that this is going to put some undue pressure on other parts of state government. So we'll let them give you their versions of the debate.
All right. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Wayne Wislowski. I'm with the Department of Administration, Real Estate, and Construction Services. And the handout you're receiving is just an overview of all the state agencies that have custodial control of state property, so it gives you a sense of what type of the range of possibilities that we have when we're looking at land sales. You will notice that one thing to mention is this is the second time in 2003 we also had a requirement to sell 5.505 million worth of land. We exceeded that requirement by selling 7.5, and that's on the second page of the handout. If you turn, is a summation of all the land sales that go towards both the 2003 requirement and the 2005 requirement. Obviously, you'll see that a number of agencies have participated in helping to meet the requirement. Again, we sold, the original requirement was 5.505 million. We sold 7.5 million. We also sold the health building to the University of Minnesota, which was just under 5 million. In 2005. Since that time, Ms. Lewis testified, we're about $2.5 million short of meeting the new requirement, which is $6,440,000. And again, a number of agencies have participated in helping to meet that requirement. My concern with the land sale, the provision in the land sale bill is really what this does is cap DNR's contribution to what they've already sold. So essentially we would be looking out to trying to find other parcels of land to sell. And given that we've been at this for 8 years, I can just tell you that we haven't identified what that property would be to meet that remaining land sale requirement.
All right, thank you. And Senator Olson.
And Madam Chair, I'm not at all in disagreement with the gentleman from the Department of Administration, but I think he gives you a picture of the challenge when you put out a dollar figure and say you have to sell land. And DNR has sold the amount that's in there, 2.1 or 2.2 million. They own most of the land, however. Most of the acreage, maybe not the value, but most of the acreage of land is owned by DNR. And part of the problem is they have been trying very hard to do that. you heard of a couple of examples in our further earlier discussion, but they have a list of properties that are 356.06 acres that are available for over-the-counter sales that are valued at $8,425,085. And they are, you know, some of them are, if there's there's one of them, if they sold one parcel of 40 acres, the minimum bid is $2.8 million, that would take care of it. Nobody is buying. And the reason, part of the reason is we have hamstrung the DNR, and this is our policy, and I'm not complaining about it, but first of all, they cannot sell below market, the appraised value. That is in statute, and people now are looking for a bargain or they're not buying. It's the economic times that is making it difficult. The second provision is that last year we added that they cannot sell anything that is part of any outdoor recreational system, and that covers virtually every major piece of land that we have that might be somewhat desirable, whether it was somebody looking for hunting lands or whatever. That can't be done. And third, they came in with some requests for in this bill for some other sales. They originally asked that it could be go to the general fund to give them that flexibility in case they could sell them. That has been changed, so it has to go over to the Water Rec Fund. So we've said to DNR, go climb this wall, but you got to do it with both two hands behind your back and one leg. So, it's an impossibility. And so I don't always agree with, as I didn't with the appraisal on that little piece of land, I understand what's driving them, and I think it's an unfair thing to do. The Office of Management and Budget is frustrated, too, because this provision was put in 2005 at $6.4 million. They've been plugging away, other agencies as well. They extended the deadline to 2007, 2009, now 2011. And it's still, we're $2.5 million away. But if my original bill introduced was a repealer, which essentially would have put us, they would have put $2.5 million of more deficit that we'd have to resolve. So that clearly has a fiscal impact. The provision that we added, which just essentially exempts DNR, saying you've done what you could, and when that is when the law plays out that the deficit is shared among agencies, that it's not going to have to come out of DNR's hide, is the way I put it. That is what's currently in the bill, and so that it doesn't take away the requirement to sell. And we've got another year for that. And then you can play the game. We can continue to do as management and budget has, is to, in our forecast, it says that there's $2.5 million of revenue in there that's coming from this that's not possible to fill. So we either continue to do that in our forecast and then show the next time around that we didn't get that income, and then keep extending this forever, or someday we're going to just have to bite the bullet, or hopefully, if the economy turns around, perhaps some land could be sold. But I think part of the reason I have pursued this as vigorously as I could is that we've got to face the reality that this is not a good way of balancing the budget. It's just throwing out a dollar figure and saying, go sell land and make that work. Because when we hit the economic times that we have, it has not been possible. So I hope you will leave this provision in the bill, and it's going to have to get worked out. But it's going to be a fiscal issue that we need to resolve. And what the Department of Administration has, I think, clearly called that into mind too. If you feel that, and if at some point you feel that DNR has got to pick up more of the load, then I think we're going to have to give them a tool to do it, because we've taken away all those tools.
Thank you, Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, as you can see, although I carry the land bill, I have about 18 different authors, and some are more passionate than others.
That sounds familiar. I think that's what the omnibus bill will look like, too. So we appreciate you being here, Senator Olson. Are there any questions about this section? All right. We'll hear more about it when we get to Senator Cohen's committee, no doubt.
Yes.
All right. Is there any further discussion on the bill? Would anyone else like to be heard on Senate File 2864? All right. Did we make any amendments? We did make an amendment.
Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 2864 be...
As amended,
be considered for the omnibus bill and laid on the table.
On that motion. Senator Scogin, you're good with that, correct?
Yep.
All right. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee.
Well, we need an author. is Ms. Frenette still here?
She abandoned us.
Okay, she's looking for it. Why doesn't, maybe she can come and start talking.
You're a saint.
But we gotta, we'll just wait a minute. Who's a co-author?
You nailed it.
Senator Scogin, you want to describe Senator Saxog's bill?
I sure would. What is it?
Oh, you're a co-author on Chaudhry's bill. Sorry.
Yeah.
Wrong bill.
Can we do something parliamentary to get me on? I'm willing if we're not.
Well, we're just trying to move along here.
Okay.
Does Senator Saxog have co-authors? We don't have any listed. Oh, it's an engrossment, so we don't know. He's probably in. Is education? They're not still. Are they still meeting?
No, we're done at 10. We were done at 10.
Good.
Time's getting to be now.
Senator Scogin, I think you're a co-author on the walk-in public access program.
Okay.
You're hired. Oh, here comes Senator Chaudhry. You're off the hook this time.
Off the hook. They were going to do
you
this.
Go ahead.
No, they were going to have the co-author do it.
We were going to have him do your bill. So if you'd prefer to do your bill, you're on. All right, Senator Chaudhry, Senate File 3297.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I apologize. I had some constituents out in the hall. 3297 creates a structure, not overly detailed, but the general structure for a walk-in access program in Minnesota. It's the, in general, it's a program that has been used in a variety of other states around the country to allow hunters to hunt on private land. And it's a voluntary program that usually a farmer or other type of landowner signs up for. They're paid a certain amount of money per acre. And then during the hunting season, a map is created or is available of all of the different parcels that are available, and people can hunt on them. South Dakota is one of the prime examples of the closest walk-in access program. And I've got a variety of witnesses that are going to speak to it, but I just basically wanted to kind of lay out the philosophy of it, and we can go over the, you know, DNR and Bowser and others can go over some of the particulars of it. But I wanted to talk about access and the discussion of access that takes place in the book Last Child in the Woods that many of us know about, written by Richard Louv. Talks about saving our children from nature deficit disorder. And he goes, there are a variety of causes that he talks about, but one of the chapters is actually named the criminalization of natural play. And it refers to some of the things that we actually do both privately and publicly that actually discourage our interaction with the outdoors. Just a couple of passages I was just hoping to read to you. Countless communities have virtually outlawed unstructured outdoor natural play, often because of the threat of lawsuits, but also because of a growing obsession with order. Many parents and kids now believe outdoor play is verboten even when it is not. Perception is 9/10 of the law. One source of constriction is private government. Today, there are more than 57 million Americans living in homes ruled by condominium, cooperative, and homeowners associations. And most housing tracts, condos, planned communities, in the past three decades, are controlled by strict covenants that discourage or ban the kind of outdoor play many of us enjoyed as children. Public government also restricts children's access to nature. One example, in Pennsylvania, where three brothers, ages 8, 10, and 12, spent 8 months and their own money to build a treehouse in their backyard. The district council ordered the boys to tear it down because they had no building permit. Other stringent restrictions on children's outdoor play spring from our efforts to protect nature from human population pressures. For example, to protect the endangered Arroyo southwestern toad, 3,000 acres of camping and fishing in the Angeles Natural Forest were closed year-round. At California's Oceano Dunes region, kite flying has been banned because kites scare off a protected species of shorebird. If endangered and threatened species are to coexist with humans, adults and children do need to tread lightly. But poor land use decisions, which reduce accessible nature in cities and other areas, do far more damage to the environment than do children. The disappearance of accessible open space escalates the pressure on those few natural places that do remain. Local flora is trampled, fauna die or relocate, and nature-hungry people follow in their four-wheel drive vehicles or on their motorcycles. Meanwhile, the regulatory message is clear. Islands of nature that are left by the graders are to be seen, not touched. And so, Madam Chair, there's a lot that this book goes into, but an important part of our growing disconnect with nature is the lack of access. And that's what Mr. Louvre talks about. The nature deficit order describes the human costs of alienation from nature. And the purpose of his book is to convey knowledge that may inspire us to choose a different path, one that leads to a nature-child reunion. And so part of the overall context of this is to do things here in the Capitol that improve our access, all of our access to nature. The walk-in access programs around the country have generally been extremely successful, relatively inexpensive, and now with federal funding that has been devoted to these types of programs, the possibility of doing such a program in Minnesota has become more and more realistic. A couple of years ago, we in the legislature asked the DNR to create to study a walk-in access program in Minnesota and make recommendations for it. That report was issued in 2008. Since then, and that report laid out a number of challenges in creating a walk-in access program. But the overarching point of view, at least among sportsmen, appears to be that we need this type of thing. And as I read from Richard Louvre's book, it's important to our society as well. So I've created some general parameters for creating a program, a pilot program in Minnesota, in a particular areas of the state, to see how the nuts and bolts of this program, such a program, would work, and where permanent funding for the program might occur. Some barriers include, of course, funding, but I think that there are a lot of sportsmen who are interested in, once again, stepping up and using monies from either their licenses or other areas to fund it. But now we have the open fields legislation from the federal government that provides millions of dollars to states in matching funds to do that. So now we have a way that if we can put a little bit of our own money in, we have backing from the federal government as well. But this bill creates the pilot program for the DNR then to come back and suggest to us permanent funding sources. And my bill only suggests a one-time expenditure to create this pilot, and so that we know, get the nuts and bolts worked out, and a permanent funding source established. But there are other challenges, and I think there have been a lot of people who are working them out. What should the size of a tract be? What lead time should be given the geographic area where such a program would fit best? The payment levels, trespassing issues, who will administer, who will be eligible? Will this help or hurt local businesses? The dissemination of the information. Would volunteers be allowed? Would this be at the expense of other resource efforts? And of course, the funding source. So I held a couple of stakeholder meetings over the past month to go over these types of details. The DNR has also created its own working group to do so, involving many of the same players. And the DNR has come up with a variety of good proposals, and it's not my intent for my bill to substitute any of what they're trying to do. I think they've come up with some good ideas, but I want to establish a general walk-in access program in law, and then let the practitioners flesh out the details. So that's the intent of this bill.
It's a big change.
We've got a variety of. I think we've got some people who'd like to testify as well.
Okay. Are there questions for Senator Chaudhry? All right, let's go to your testifiers. First, we've got from the DNR, Bob Meyer, Ed Bogus. Okay, or Ed Bogus.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Ed Bogus with Division of Fish and Wildlife. And Senator Chaudhry has laid out the history fairly well. The report that we did to the legislature in January of 2008 indicated that walk-in programs work pretty well to the west of Minnesota. To the east of the state, there's been less consistent success. So we do think a pilot approach makes sense to evaluating how a program could work in Minnesota. We don't have a position on this bill. It's not something that's in the governor's budget. We have Mr. Penning, Bill Penning from our staff is here, who's been helping to facilitate a stakeholder group with the Board of Water and Soil Resources that has come up with a number of kind of specific ideas on how a pilot program could work, and he's available to talk about some of the details of how we would envision, if this were to become law, how it would work. Obviously, the source of funding is an issue for this committee and of some concern to the department, given that Game and Fish Fund is identified, and I think as the committee knows, the Game and Fish Fund is currently fairly healthy. It's got a $13 or $14 million balance, but expenditures are exceeding revenues right now, as often occurs late in a cycle after a fee increase, which was 10 years ago, to the tune of about $3 million a year. So currently the 2013 into fiscal year forecast is about a $4 million balance. So whatever was appropriate in this bill would reduce that balance by that amount. So, and I know there's been discussions, and Senator Chaudhry has a bill also on fee increases that you've talked about. And so there's the potential that declining balance could be addressed in the future. But if this bill becomes law, it's just going to accelerate the time that the fund is going to run out of money, and obviously we can't operate in a deficit mode. So I guess I'm going to just limit my comments to that. In terms of how the program could specifically work, I'd defer to Bill Penning, who's here, but I think Mr. Lyons, because the work group envisions that this would be a cooperative project primarily administered through the Board of Soil and Water Resources and the Soil and Water Conservation Districts, you know, I'm going to defer to the other testifiers for those details.
I guess my question for Mr. Bogus and for Senator Chaudhry, if we don't do the fishing license increase, do you think it would be advisable to spend this amount of money? But if we do it, you think that will make it fiscally responsible?
Madam Chair, I'm only seeking a one-time expenditure, and I think that this pilot program could probably be funded between $250,000 to $500,000. But in the context of the fishing license fee increase, I think we have we almost killed two birds with one stone when we talk about the issue of the imbalance in the Game and Fish Fund between wildlife and fisheries. We could increase the amount that fisheries is contributing through the fishing license fee increase and provide some funding for an additional wildlife activity. So that goes to the issue of the imbalance between wildlife and fishery spending. So I think we have two potential positives that can really come out of this proposal and the other one. But I don't think that this does long-term damage to any future deficits because I'm only seeking this one time. And then the idea would be after this pilot would be for the DNR to report on a variety of different types of funding sources. And we've talked about all sorts of different possibilities. We've talked about game and small game license surcharge. We've talked about a walk-in access endorsement stamp. We've talked about Game and Fish Fund. We've talked about maybe even one of the hunting groups taking it out of that stamp money. We've talked about the Outdoor Heritage Fund in creating a criteria that would fit what they do if they were interested in funding this type of program. They could if they wanted to, as long as it fit their protect, preserve, and enhance criteria. So there are a variety of things that we can look at, but I think the Game and Fish Fund, a one-time amount out of the Game and Fish Fund this year will help get it going, and we can then go to talk about the permanent funding sources later. The big kahuna is to draw down the federal money. I think other states have spent between $2 and $4 million roughly per year on this, and so a small amount out of whatever surcharge or stamp or other grant money from the state could be easily supplemented by the federal government. I would have been interested in seeking that matching fund now, but we have a problem with the open fields legislation. They're still working out the particulars of their rules, and so we're kind of waiting for those to be passed before we can actually seek the grants.
Mr. Bogus, I don't know if you wanted to comment on my question or not. We had asked if the governor has an opinion about the fishing license fees, and I suspect we will not ever get an answer because we usually don't. Not for your lack of trying, I'm sure, but we don't usually get commitments like that from him.
I guess I don't have anything further to say.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Good answer.
Senator Chaudhry, what is the typical payment that's made to a landowner or farmer in this kind of program?
Madam Chair, it varies depending on the success of the program and the enthusiasm of the participants. It can range between from $5, $8, $10, $15
per
acre. What the DNR has been discussing is starting at I believe starting at $15 an acre for this pilot, and then adding on certain kind of kickers if there is a landowner signs a longer term contract, then they get an extra dollar or two, that type of thing. So they've really been coming up with some good ideas to flesh this out, and I appreciate the involvement of Bowser as well, because they've worked with landowners and they've got the experience, the most amount of experience in doing that, and have the most the best suggestions on it. The initial intent is to layer this on existing programming to seek out acreages that are already in CRP, for example, and then ask those individuals if they're interested in an extra payment to be part of it, because we know that they are already interested in conservation, and we'll ask them if they are interested in access as well. And then that can have another quantum benefit, and that is keeping that CRP from being de-enrolled.
And Mr. Bogus, would this take staff time at the DNR? I mean, we don't have a fiscal note, right? Because we don't have a dollar amount set in stone here. Do you have
Madam Chair, yes. Either at the DNR or at the Board of Soil and Water Resources, depending on how it was done. But we've, as Senator Chaudhry had mentioned, we've worked with the board on a work group of stakeholders and agency staff, and they've come up with a series of recommendations on what a pilot program should entail, and that includes some administration, some printing, signs, things like that, in addition to the land rental costs or contract costs to get the access to the land. So, and obviously there's some scale involved here too, and I'm not sure at what funding level we would consider a pilot to be a viable program. Maybe Mr. Lyons or Mr. Penning would have some opinion on that, but there would be a need to have some staff and administrative expenditures allowable out of whatever amount is appropriated.
Okay. Senator Fredrickson, you still have a question? Okay, sorry. Any other questions? Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Chaudhry, I'm just curious about this. In a situation where, a landowner decides to enter into this agreement to have the land open, and there is a need for infrastructure because the bill says, public access, is there a need to have other agencies involved in here, or how does that determination of open access actually work if there is no infrastructure to really have access, and who is responsible for ensuring? Because the public, I guess, has the assumption that this piece of land will be open and that they have access to this land. So how is it done currently? I'm curious about how infrastructure is handled around these projects.
Madam Chair, Senator Torres, it's an important question. The infrastructure itself is not too heavy. It mainly consists of signage around a particular parcel. There isn't generally a parking lot or something like that built. That doesn't go to that extent. There's a sign, and I think usually any type of what is normally a farm field has some sort of entry into it that was formerly used by tractors or something like that, or the person just parks on the side of the road. So there isn't a real creation of a parking lot or anything like that. You're just basically highlighting that parcel on a map. There's signage around it that when you get there that indicates that this is the walk-in access program, usually some signs about warnings about don't trespass over into other people's property, or respecting the person's land, picking up litter, that type of thing. But their infrastructure is usually confined to signage.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Chaudhry, have you gotten any interest on the parts of farmers to participate in something like this?
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, there are farmers who are interested in participating, just as they are interested in participating in our CRP and other easement programs. I think it would be fair to say that some of the agricultural community as a whole is has voiced concerns on usually around liability and trespass issues. But these programs are very popular in other agricultural states, South Dakota, Nebraska, others, and they have very willing participants.
All right, thank you. Other questions for Mr. Bogus? All right, Kevin Lines, I think is Gary Leaf is listed next. Why don't we go to Gary?
Morning, members. My name is Gary Leaf. I'm Executive Director of Sportsman for Change, and I'm testifying on behalf of the walk-in bill. I think that I guess what reminds me a little bit of this is that a few years ago, 1998, Microsoft, there was a big article on Microsoft that Windows 98 was everything that Windows 95 was supposed to be. This is a START program. It's an idea to work out a lot of the factors. It's a pilot program. It's, you know, corporations do it all the time. And I think it's to address a couple of points. One point is that in Minnesota, we're projected to be, have been the fastest growing state in the Midwest, more than Wisconsin and South Dakota and North Dakota and so on and so forth. So as our population increases, there's going to be an increased need by citizens for recreational opportunity. That's just going to be a demographic fact, along with everybody's going to be getting older, I guess. Another one is that we've got, you know, a lot of conservation tools out on the landscape right now, whether they be CRP and RIM, WRP, a lot of those, and so on and so forth. And it may be a good time to consider what the future of the state's going to be with regard to the needs for recreational opportunity and, you know, what existing assets we've got out there, and if we can use a fraction of the money to get some type of opportunity for public access. And I think that there's a lot of the people I've talked about through the state, especially when we're doing the legacy amendment on the Outdoor Heritage Fund, really feel that the time has come to make a slight, you know, an investment and get this type of product off the ground for the citizens of Minnesota. And I think an awful lot of, you know, hunters and sportsmen in general do not own private land, probably will have, because they've got less ties to rural Minnesota than they've ever had, less ties to the farm. It's not like it was maybe 40 years ago where, you know, a lot of people were coming from our rural areas of Minnesota to the city. They might not have those connections, let alone the youth. So it'll just maybe put some an opportunity out there for the public to participate a little bit more and take advantage of a lot of the existing programs we've got out there.
Mr. Leaf, I agree with everything you said about access by the public and the growing need for those opportunities. I guess the question would be, if we limit this to agricultural areas of the state, are we really going to serve that need as well as we could for the metropolitan area for people who don't have as many opportunities for
hunting? On that one, I think the numbers are, if I recall, Minnesota has more hunters per capita in Minneapolis and St. Paul than any city in the United States except Houston. So most of them are going to be, coming from the metro area. They'll be used by people in those areas as well. The question is that, you know, there's going to be an increased population. I'm not sure how many of the easements in the metro, around the metro area, that this might apply to or could apply to, but certainly if there's some local opportunity, but you might get crowding. Certain areas of the state, southeastern Minnesota, you know, really doesn't have a lot of public land. That's pretty much private land down there. And, you know, they're running into a lot of access problems, and a lot of people from the metro go to those areas. So I think it could be applied to areas around the metro, and it would be flexible enough.
Just on that, Madam Chair, I think you make a good point. I don't think that our walk-in access program should ultimately be confined to one part of the state. I think we should especially try for areas that are closer to the cities. The only reason why we confine this to this area in this pilot project is because we know that This type of landscape has been successful in other states. We want to get the program up and running and get the nuts and bolts make it successful from the beginning, and then go from there. That's the only reason why we've confined it to this area of the state for the pilot.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other questions? All right. Thank you.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Lee. Mr. Lines.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. I'm Kevin Lines. I'm the Conservation Easement Manager for the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Just make a couple comments regarding this bill. We have been, first off, along with DNR, of course, it's not in the governor's budget for the board, so but we have been involved in the working group process and providing input to Senator and the other partners within that. So conceptually, we support the concept. I might also add that it's been a fast coming together quickly. We have not had the opportunity to deal and work with our local soil and water conservation districts and the Minnesota Association of Districts that we work with to get their input and support into it. And at this point, conceptually, we believe this opportunity can work. We support a pilot project. We do know that in the 2008 Federal Farm Bill, the Open Fields Voluntary Access Habitat Incentive Program has $50 million identified. USDA has not appropriated those funds yet. However, we've been in contact with Washington USDA, and we believe that will occur within 90 days, and they'll have $17 million available in fiscal year 10, $17 million in fiscal year 11, and $16 million in fiscal year 12. So we believe that there's a good opportunity for Minnesota if we're prepared to take advantage of those federal dollars for a walk-in access program. We could be successful with that. We think it's an additional tool in the toolbox to work with our private landowners. The local soil and water conservation districts could provide that. However, we have to ensure that, in fact, when the details are rolled out, that there are funds for administration of the program. This will take additional work, and so those priorities are going to have to be met to do that. But we certainly support the concept, and we'll work with our partners in the group to make it as successful as possible.
All right. Thank you. Question, Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Lines, the federal program, how much administration will be involved with that? Like if you are going to enroll, say, CREPland or our CRP, I remember when CREP was being implemented, some of that required a lot of work to identify precisely the parcels that were being enrolled. It was more than just going out and saying, well, we're going to enroll 40 acres now. If a landowner came in wanting to enroll into this federally funded program, would it be that simple that you could just put up signs on those 40 or 80 acres, or would you need to have a legal description, precise legal description as to what parcels are being enrolled and more legal details and maybe even some surveying work?
Madam Chair, Senator Fredrickson, I'm, of course, speaking without the details of the USDA program, so I'm going to go on what I believe would occur. They would use the same methodology. Farm Service Agency and USDA and Minnesota would use the same field identifications that they do use for the CRP program. So it's not a legal description. It's simply by field tract that's, you know, common in the agricultural areas. But, of course, this program would require signing and some kind of other mapping identification so that the public, as well as the landowners, know what land is enrolled and available for walk-in access and those lands that are not. And accordingly, enforcement would have to occur if there were any issues related to that. My belief is that what the USDA is looking at with the open fields legislation is that states will be provided the opportunity to request funds for the program and would ultimately be the response, the state and or who is going to administer the program at the state level would be responsible for the administration of that out of those funds. That's going to be the state's share of this partnership through the federal government. But at this point, they don't have their interim rules are not out for public comment yet, so we'll have to wait to see the details.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You answered in part one of the questions I have. Do, besides signage, when you identify lands that are open, do you put something up on the website? How do folks, say they live in the metro area, know that some of these things are available to them ahead of time?
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, I mean, typically what's done, and, you know, there's several iterations that we could do, but certainly we would have the potential to use a website as one tool, but typically what they do is actually a printing of a county, call it a county atlas booklet specific to the walk-in access program. In this case, it would be, you know, at least according to the language that's presently in the bill, would be a pilot program, so we would have that portion of the state that would be identified as the target, and those lands would be identified on a, you know, kind of like a 16-county pilot type of atlas thing, as well as I think we could make it available on the website as well.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hand.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Senator Chaudhary, and I don't know if Mr. Lyons, if you're the right person to ask, but Senator Chaudhary, you'd mentioned earlier that there were number of issues around the bill. This is a structure, and not all the issues have been resolved. But could you talk a little bit, or I'm just thinking about potential liability issues, and if a landowner gets into this program and a hunter were to enter his property and trip over a fallen tree and gun goes off, somebody gets injured, how are those things typically handled in other jurisdictions, other states? And just what is the liability issues that are surrounding this?
Madam Chair, Senator Hahn,
Chaudhary.
It's an issue that comes up, but not often confronted. Having said that, I deal with that issue on lines of 14 through 17, and maybe Mr. Knopf could explain what
he's getting the statute.
What actually that refers to it.
Mr. Knopf, do you
Madam Chair and Senator Hand, that actually provides the protection for liability for the landowner. Under current law in Minnesota, if a landowner allows the use of their land for the public without charge, they are afforded protection from liability. It's limited a little bit, but they are afforded protection. And what this would do is say that this payment would not be counted as a fee for access of the land. That it's a different type of a thing. So basically, it would be treated the same as if the land was not offered for fee. So there would be protection for the landowner, similar to if you were to let somebody use your land for free.
Thank you.
All right. Any other questions? All right. Thank you very much. I think we have one other person who asked to testify, Jim. I can't say your last name.
Bazat.
Did I say that right? Sorry, I should know. Bazat? Is that French?
That's Greek.
Greek. That's why I could do it if it was French, and it wouldn't be Bazat. Okay, so now I'm catching on. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, for the record, my name is Jim Bazat. I'm the legislative liaison for the Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance, better known as MOHA. The walk-in access program is an important program for the sporting community. As has previously been stated, as the population increases, we're getting further and further removed from the rural roots. Back in the dark ages when I first started hunting, I was introduced to hunting through family, friends, and relatives that had relatives that owned farms out west in the south. And at that time, there wasn't nearly the pressure that there is today. And we were able to go out and see game, harvest game, and really get your juices flowing to the idea of going hunting. Nowadays, unless you've got deep pockets, which fewer and fewer of us have nowadays, leasing private land to hunt on is becoming more and more of an issue. As the pheasant population has increased, it's becoming even harder to get on because of the fact that the farmers have realized that they've got an extra revenue source by leasing land out. We've got our WMAs, but on any of the given weekends opening weekend, Thanksgiving weekend, NEA, those areas are absolutely overwhelmed with hunters. This is actually even a recruitment issue, and we have certainly heard over the course of time that we are losing, we're losing our hunting base in the license fees, we're losing the fishing base. This is a recruitment issue because of the fact that it is very easy to introduce a young hunter to the sport of hunting by going along with family members or friends to go pheasant hunting. It isn't nearly as difficult as the duck hunting or the deer hunting issue. The walk-in program would even have impact on the dove hunting. So to conclude, MOHA and its member groups are very much in favor of the walk-in program for the welfare of the sporting community in our state.
Thank you very much. Questions? Senator Rummel.
Madam Chair, this really isn't a question pertaining to this particular testimony, but I'm just curious. If you're a farmer, do you have to, can you hunt on your own land, and do you need a license for that? I'm just curious because I don't know enough about this.
Madam Chair, Senator Rummel, Senator, yes, Chaudhry, to both.
You can hunt, but you need a license anywhere in the state.
Some small game. Small game hunting.
Mr. Knopf.
Well, Madam Chair, small game hunting.
There's some exceptions, yeah.
There's an exception for small game hunting on your own land.
Like, what does small game cover?
Well, Madam Chair, that would be rabbits, squirrels, those sorts of things. But, I mean, you know, pheasants are considered small game, too, but I think you'd still need to have a pheasant stamp. I don't think we, Mr. Boggess is back there. He may want to clarify, but I don't recall if you can hunt pheasants. I think you have to have a pheasant stamp to hunt pheasants, so I'm not sure that would apply, even though that's small game. But generally, the other small game that you don't need that you wouldn't need a stamp for, I know those you can hunt on your own land without a license.
Just curious.
It's only on your own land.
Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, I just wanted to respond and maybe include another issue in something that Mr. Bassat said. You know, back years ago, farms were 160 acres or 200 acres or a half section land was a big farm. And if you saw some ground you'd like to hunt on, you could see the farmer's home, and you'd know who to go ask. You went up to the farm place, and you went to the house or the barn, wherever the people were, and asked, well, can I hunt there? Mm-hmm. Well, that's really changed. The average size of farms now is much, much larger than that, several hundred acres or 1,000 acres. And the owner might live 10 miles away. It might be CRP, and they might not care if you hunt it there. It would give you permission to hunt, but you don't know where to go to ask that owner of that land where to hunt. They might be 10 miles away. They might even now live in the Twin City area someplace, and you don't know who owns that land. One big advantage I see for the a walk-on program would be the landowner doesn't care if you hunt there, you can put up a sign, you don't have to worry about who owns it, we're going to get permission from them, go through all those details. If there's a sign there, you know it's open to hunting.
No, that's a good point, Senator Fredrickson. Absolutely. All right. Thank you very much, Mr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members?
I guess we don't. Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on Senate File 3297? Welcome, Mr. Peterson.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Tom Peterson. I represent the Minnesota Farmers Union, and we are currently opposed to a walk-in access program, and we have concerns with the program. It came out a couple of years ago. They did a report, the DNR, and we were interviewed for Farmers Union, Farm Bureau, and we talked to the groups about and put our input in. Then we took it through our county process around the state and really talked to our members about it, whether this is a good thing or a bad thing. And I really paid attention. I drove out to western Minnesota, southwestern Minnesota, because like you say, in my county, in Pine County, average farm size is 250 acres, but you get out to Wilkin County and the average farm size is 1,000 acres. And so, as Senator Fredrickson was saying, so then, you know, I really tried to ask the farmers, is this a good thing? You know, and knowing that they know pretty familiar with the PLOTS program in North Dakota. And I was very surprised because my first inclination was, you know, you're going to get like North Dakota, South Dakota, you're going to get $5-6 an acre. Isn't that a good thing? And $15 an acre would be even better. But I was surprised that, you know, that farmers were really just uncomfortable with it. And as Senator Chaudhry said, our concerns have been mostly with private property rights and trespassing. You've talked a lot about how you're going to run the program today. I haven't heard hardly anything about how you're going to enforce the program and how the DNR is going to deal with enforcement and concerns on managing the program or, and that. And I think that's a very real concern out in the countryside as we visited with our members. The liability Senator Hahn brought up, I'm pretty comfortable with that. And after looking at that, I think you're always going to be open to a lawsuit. Another thing we've heard from our members that's a concern is where it's going to go. Like Senator Fredrickson said, you can post it and people can walk on it and everything. Well, I have my farm and I live there, and all of a sudden my neighbor, who may live in Edina or 10 miles away, decides to post that property. Now I've got a private hunting a land open for hunting where my kids and my family and everybody lives right next to me. And I'm dealing with that, and I'm dealing with trespassers and cattle and whatever. That's just some of the concerns we're hearing. And I always, I feel pretty strongly about this. After, talking to farmers at auctions and feed mills, I've been really interested in this issue. A couple other quick comments. I think, too, that legislature really needs to look at what's going on access. I was down in Winona County last night. I was in Benton County with senators working on Green Acres, and we created this rural preserve program where we're making farmers make decisions. I don't know how many farmers came up to me last night and said, I let people hunt on my land all the time and, either charge them or don't charge them. But he said, now I'm going into this rural preserve program that the legislature is going to, I'm not going to do it. And I'm not, and people think they're going to come and hunt on my property. That's a lot more acres than this open land hunting access program is going to take care of. And so we really got to look at these issues and how it's going to affect that. Finally, I do appreciate that's a limited program. Senator Chaudhry had a meeting. I appreciate we're able to go to that. I participated in the DNR walk-in. They had a working group for a little bit, but I backed off of it because of our opposition. No matter what you do this year, the bill says if you pass it this year, we're going to do a report next year. And, we'll continue to visit with our members about it because it is money that could be in their pocket. There's a couple of things, like there was money appropriated in the farm bill. Since we took our official position a couple of years ago, we did pass the farm bill that appropriated the open fields. We also passed the legacy money that's complicated the whole issue. And so, I do... and as Mr. Lyons said, this has been kind of fast and coming together. So just a couple of comments. Oppose the bill. We'll continue to work on it and, be assured that people, that's how they feel. But I've continued to ask, and I feel strongly about it. So thank you.
Senator Fredrickson.
Madam Chair, Mr. Peterson. When it comes right down to it, it'll be up to the individual farmer whether or not they chose to participate or not participate. If a farmer opposed to it, they just would not have to just decline the offer. If their neighbor wants to enroll, they certainly could. The neighbor might want to raise sunflowers, corn, and soybeans, and maybe the other neighbor doesn't like sunflowers. But it's that landowner's decision what they're going to raise and who they let on their property. I can see the concern with allowing this access on land adjacent to the farm site, to a farmstead of the neighbors, and I think that's something that could be taken into consideration when you enroll land into the program.
Madam Chair, I came in late too, and Senator Fredrickson, to that point, and that's another thing. I thought just private decision, and I think and a lot of the things. I don't know if you had the report or the walk-in access report. There's actually like 8 bullets on like the second page that I think are pretty good. And if you're going to design a program, and I think that is another important point, because that's something I think is real. Keep in mind, where the states where it works good. I don't know if the DNR mentioned this or not or showed you the map, but it works really good in the states to the west of us, and to the states to the east of us, it doesn't. We're kind of in the middle. We have a population of 5 million. I'm not sure what North Dakota and South Dakota have, but it's probably about a tenth of that. And so we do have some different, deals that I hope you consider in Minnesota that's unique to our state. So,
thank you, Mr. Peterson. Any other questions? All right. Thanks.
Well,
thanks,
Madam Chair.
Mr. Kubley.
Yeah, I think one of the difficulties I think in visiting with some farmers in my district is that, you know, even when they get permission from a neighbor, you know, they may not always be aware of where the property boundaries are, and so you enter on a new person's property either knowingly or unknowingly, and, you know, that tends to cause some friction in the countryside, too. I think, you know, if you don't have, you know, specific parameters on where a property line ends, that would pose some difficulty.
Madam Chair, just one consideration on that. This actually might be slightly better than improve the situation that Senator Kubley discussed, because when you just simply give someone permission to hunt on your land, that land isn't necessarily demarcated in that type of informal arrangement. But in here, there is actually a plat map where the borders are highlighted, and there's actual signage, so that this would actually probably be better than what the current arrangement is with regards to trespassing. But we know that, I mean, trespassing happens now. This won't encourage or discourage that. Actually, it'll probably discourage it a little bit, because we're actually putting a little bit of signage and mapping things out.
All right. Would anyone else like to testify on the bill? All right. Senator Chaudhry, I would assume that you would want to put this in the Game and Fish bill, or did you want to put it in the Omnibus bill?
However you want to track it, it can be in the Game and Fish bill. It could.
That would be fine. We should just lay it on the table until we do the Game and Fish bill, I think. All right. So any other discussion? Hearing none, Senator Chaudhry moves that Senate File 3297 be recommended for inclusion in the Game and Fish Bill and laid on the table. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, members.
Senator Saxhog. Senator Saxhog, I just want to remind members, that at least the ones that are here, that we're meeting at 6 o'clock tonight in room 107. And we only have about 4 bills, so I don't think it'll be a late night, but we need you there. Senator Saxhog.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I will be there. And just playing a little bit off of our last bill that we reviewed, You'll note that the things that are being done in north central and northeastern Minnesota with access or make it possible that in those areas we don't have to worry about access, because we're preventing fragmentation, consolidating lands, and particularly the conservation easements, I think, are doing a good job. So, just an aside. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Senate File 1698 is a bill relating to water rulemaking that made policy deadline last year, but wasn't included due to our lack of funds. There's now a surplus from collected fees. I guess they're up about 30% in the environmental fund. And I do have an A1 amendment, or it's not A1, it's the A3 amendment. That I'd like to move. It would appropriate $75,000 from that fund for a study group.
How much? Did this go straight to finance? Did it go to policy? All right, Senator Saxhog.
Could I move that?
maybe we should. You should present the bill.
Okay, I'll present
and
the bill
first.
Well,
first.
That one other thing I would like to mention, though, that needs to be changed amended, it can be oral, is 2.19 on the first engrossment, which says January 15th, 2011. It probably, because it'll be this year, it should be 2012 would be when the report would come forward.
Oh, I see. Okay. So, all right. Do you want to, all right, why don't you move the date change on the bill? On Senate File 1698.
I would move 2.19 to change that to 2012 from 2011.
All right. On that motion, any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What I'm interested in doing here is this whole process we use as a state to deal with water issues, and, you know, I don't know if I'd call it the possibility of streamlining or whatever, but this study group would consist of one member of each one of the following agencies: DNR, Bowser, the PCA, EQB, Ag, and the Department of Health, which are basically those agencies that deal with water. And it would direct the Department of Administration to appoint that study group, and the final outcome would allow for a report back to the legislature assessing and evaluating the continuation of rules in whole or in part on the various water quality issues, including but not limited to non-degradation buffer requirements and zoning setbacks. So, you know, this is kind of been bouncing around my head along with my neighbor just down the hall. Senator Olson is her bill is kind of reviewing all the different agencies. My idea is to go at it a little different way. Take one of the areas that we do the most work on and see how our process works. It affects us in many different ways, I don't think any of us want to lower our environmental standards. However, when we're dealing with water and water permitting, for example, I think it would be good to be able to make sure that we're doing it in the most efficient way possible. With that, I'd be happy to stand for questions on the bill. I have some testimony that could happen if there are any questions that I can't answer.
Okay. So, Ms. Frenette, did you want to be heard on this or just answer questions?
Madam Chair, members, I'm Lisa Frenette. I represent the Builders Association of Minnesota. I'd be happy to stand for testimony if you'd like me to, or just answer questions, however you would like to do this. We did stand for several questions last year as we moved through the environmental policy bill, and be happy to continue to do so.
Okay. Are there questions? Members. Senator Fredrickson.
I don't have questions. I just have a more than a little skeptical that this will result for anything usable, having some sense of the Federal Clean Water Act and the Minnesota laws and the rules that accompany the Federal Clean Water Act in the state, and also some of the Supreme Court rulings, both national and state. I don't know what we're going to accomplish with this study. I'm a little dubious that we'll accomplish anything other than have a few people attempt to work very hard on following the law if this becomes law.
What do you mean if it becomes law?
If this bill makes it through.
If the study moves forward.
If the study moves forward.
You're not assuming any results. Okay. Senator Saxon?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Fredrickson, I think that we have a long way to go in the way we present ourselves, particularly if in this particular economy where we're trying to work on jobs, and we have instances in both southern Minnesota and in northern Minnesota where water permits, in particular, have been asked for. And I have the example in Grand Rapids where UPM and Kimini is the paper manufacturer up there has basically said, okay, we are going to build a paper machine in Grand Rapids, work on issuing the permits. And And finally, after 2 years, the permits were issued. By that time, the company had something else to do with their money and built it in China or wherever they built it. And I think we've – and again, I'm environmental standards are important, but I think that a discussion of how we can more efficiently issue permits on different on the different agencies that handle water issues, I think that would be very important.
Madam Chair,
I'm in agreement that we need to issue permits as quickly as we can, but we also need to make sure that the environment is protected and that all of the regulatory process, some of which we can't control, are met. And I don't know that this study will get at that.
Well Madam Chair, Senator Frederickson, we can agree to disagree, but some things we aren't going to be able to change. There's no question about it, especially when we're talking about federal laws. And as you say, the Clean Water Act. But I think there are some things that we can do. And as with as we look back on what we're going to try to do with Senator Olson's bill, every time that we spend some time looking over our process, I think we end up saving money, saving steps, looking at more efficient ways of doing things, and you know that's the purpose of this.
Senator Frederickson.
One last comment. I certainly support improving the process, making it more efficient, making sure that we meet all the requirements. Now, I think one of the best things we can do to speed up permits is to make sure our agencies are funded well enough so that when a permit comes in, it doesn't go to the bottom of the pile and it takes a year before it works its way to the top and they can start working on it because they don't have enough staff. Now, I think we should make that these sure that the permitting agencies have enough staff and enough computers and other equipment and electronic facilities to expedite those permits.
Madam Chair, Senator Frederickson, I think you and I can agree on that without a problem. Madam Chair, Ms. Frenette has a comment she'd like to make.
Madam Chair, Senator Frederickson and members, I just want to point out one, maybe highlight an issue that we find that in some of the we have a loose association, people that kind of got together that are interested in moving this bill forward along with local governments, ourselves, and the Builders Association of Minnesota, and again, some other entities. And one of the things that we look at is in between the DNR, the PCA, and Bowser, they're all doing the same thing but separately. There's a lack of coordination between the two of them. And one of the examples is the watershed plans need to be updated every 10 years between Bowser and PCA, but both of those plans don't run congruously with each other. They run separately. And so people like our builders are following different plans, and they're trying to figure out how they can get these plans coordinated and what they can do. And the local governments also have trouble following the plans because everything is running differently from each other, and they're doing different their issues. They're not, again, there's a lack of integration between them. So part of the study would be to look at how those three agencies are doing the watershed plans or how the two agencies are putting together and coordinating their watershed plans and making them perhaps work together so that the state agencies, the local governments, and any proposer of a project knows exactly how something is supposed to work with regard to making sure that we don't denigrate water quality and we keep moving forward in terms of saving the environment and getting projects moving forward.
Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm not too sure. In the funds that we allocated for Dr. Swackhammer's framework, would some of these issues be included in what she's trying to achieve? Because I think the whole framework that she's developing is based on the way we use water and then subsequently the systems that need to be integrated to make that use both eco-friendly but good for the people that need permits. But I'm not sure if that's in her study.
We ask them to do to look at the management structures. You know, I can't remember the exact words. for water management, in addition to the kind of the substantive questions.
But that would
I think there's some overlap there. Mm-hmm.
Just wanted to bring that up, that somebody's already working on some of these questions, that I believe. And I think we get some answers next session.
Yes, I believe so, in 2011. And how does this complement, or how does this overlap with what Senator Olson is proposing? Would these be some of the questions that would be addressed by her mega task force?
Well, Madam Chair, that's the thing that's always kind of bothered me about the mega task force, is that I'm kind of looking for more specific answers on process, on areas that our major environmental agencies deal with. And, you know, water and air are the two biggest, probably, and of those two, water is probably the one that has the most agencies that are involved in different facets of it.
Okay. When you say on 1.17, you talk about the costs of the rules to state and local government and to the private sector, normally I guess I would expect you to say the costs and benefits. Where does the – is there a benefit analysis as well of the rules?
Madam Chair, I'm going to ask Ms. Frenette to answer that.
Madam Chair, members, that's not in there right now, but that brings up a great point, and it would be interesting to know what the benefits are.
Well, I think that's pretty fundamental.
I think it's very fundamental.
Madam Chair.
Senator Frederickson.
One of the benefits is staying in compliance with the 1972 Federal Clean Water Act. If we don't do that, there can be restriction on economic development communities if the economic development results in an increased discharge into an impaired waters.
Madam Chair and Senator Frederickson, we fully agree with complying with the Federal Clean Water Act, and I know that my members try their hardest at this point to comply with them. Again, the problem is that you have the Federal Clean Water Act, you've got the state of Minnesota laws, and then you've got the different agencies that are all kind of fanning out and doing their own thing and not working in a coordinated fashion together, which makes it difficult for a builder to get something accomplished and do it the right way. I'll give you, for instance, the Minnehaha Creek Watershed District. If a builder goes in to do something, say, with buffers, and they're trying to make sure they're doing the right thing, they not only have to follow the state rules, they have to follow the county rules, they have to follow the city rules, and they have to follow the Minnehaha Creek Watershed rules. None of them coordinate with each other. So they'll be following along with one process, and somebody will come out from one of the other entities and tell them that, no, that's not the right way to do it. You need to change the way you're doing it. And they have to change things up. So, again, it makes it difficult for a builder who's trying to do the right thing to do the right thing because nothing is coordinated.
Senator Chaudhry.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I personally think that this issue is been the one common theme that's come out of some of the reform hearings we've had. We've heard consistently is on the water permitting, and I think if we tackled one issue out of all of the reform efforts, this would be my number one choice. And if we did just this, we would really make a lot of headway on natural resource management. And so I think this is an important issue, and to study it, I think, is really important. And I guess my question to either of you is, have you considered adding some more stakeholders to your bill, such as local units of government, your builders groups, watershed districts, because they do, and watershed districts especially, because they don't, I think they do some permitting. Maybe they should be at the very least be considered. But I would have an exhaustive list on this because you're centering on the consistent problem that we keep hearing on. If we can really fix this the right way, we've really done some good, as long as we make sure that all the appropriate entities are at the table.
Senator Sexhog.
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, as with Senator Olson's bill, my tendency is to think that we ought to have the key agencies on that advisory committee, and then everybody else certainly should be welcome and should attend, and that exhaustive list should be in testimony, and you know, in testifiers. So that's kind of the take I have on it.
Madam Chair, Senator Saxon, aren't watershed districts and some local units issuing agencies?
Madam Chair, Senator Chaudhry, I'm sure they are.
Yes, they are.
I'm sure they are. And I'm trying, where's my list? DNR, Bowser, PCA, QB, Ag, and the Department of Health. Those are the state agencies that are involved in it. But you're right. There's local units of government, as you mentioned, that probably should be added to that. Madam Chair, I wouldn't put an exhaustive list down, but I think other issuers of water permits would be good.
Mr. Knopf.
Madam Chair, I just want to clarify something. This does not create necessarily a task force or group. It's just it's the Department of Administration consults with these people, and it does list those agencies. It also lists technical professionals with scientific expertise in water resources management and other interested parties. So basically, the commissioner can consult with whomever is interested in doing this study.
Madam Chair,
Senator Shutter.
Right, that's what I was looking at. That's why I don't think you're running the same issue as we did with Senator Olson's bill if you just list out. I've done that before when we did the green tourism study, just listing out who they should consult with, just to make sure that certain people at the table provides comfort. You could list the Mining Association too. they're always chomping at the bit to ask for more work. But I think you've just got such a comprehensive issue here. It's so vital that the stakeholders list. It sets the whole process off on the right foot. And I don't think it hurts your bill in any way to say various parties. And you don't have to amend it now, but it's just something to consider.
You know, it's some of these questions in here are just, I'm just having a hard time getting my head around this. I mean, number four says, we're asking why some regulations are deemed appropriate at the local level and others are not. And to answer that question, wouldn't you kind of have to probe the mind of every legislator who made decisions about that? I mean, how do you intend to answer those questions? Paragraph four.
Oh, okay.
But, I mean, isn't that pretty much based on the legal framework that we have set up in Minnesota laws?
Well, Madam Chair, what I'm doing here is, and so maybe this has been done a lot before, but I've yet to see it, that this group of state agencies that handles water all operate under the same laws, the same federal laws, but they do it in different ways, and they crisscross each other, and I just don't think we're as efficient as we could be. And if this study is done by the Department of Administration and they find in their findings, they say, hey, we're doing things as well as we can, so that's the way it is, well, that'll well have eased our mind that we're stuck then. That's what we're going to be doing. But I just, I'm not convinced of that.
Chair,
Senator Chaudhry.
When I read this, and maybe it's not entirely clear, but when I read it, I see answers sought to questions of how did certain laws come about? Is it just simply historical? Is it political? Is it federal? How did these regulations become deemed as appropriate?
Senator Chaudhry, I think that hits the nail on the head here on number four. We're kind of asking what's the history instead of saying where should these regulations be made? Who should be the deciders?
I mean, that's really what you're getting at, I assume, but it's just drafted in kind of an odd way to get at that.
It's true, Madam Chair, but we have to have history of all these before we can put them together anyway. But I think you make a good observation.
Sounds like a job, legislative auditor. Well, members, any other questions? Yeah, we need to wrap up here. So what's your wish, Senator Saxhog?
Well, Madam Chair, first of all, I'd like to pass the A3 amendment. Put the A3 amendment on.
Senator Saxhog moves the A3 amendment. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Saxhog moves that Senate File 1698 as amended be recommended for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill and laid on the table. On that motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Motion prevails. Thank you, members.
Madam Chair, members, I appreciate
one statement.
Mr. Knopf.
Madam Chair, before everybody leaves, I wanted to clarify what I said earlier about the small game license on your own land. I just want to be clear. I was actually wrong about the stamp. And the game and fish light laws are a little bit nuanced, and sometimes you forget about the nuances. But let me just read the
you?
Two. Even me. I just wanted to clarify. It says a person may take small game without a small game license on land occupied by the person as a principal residence. And that's what I was going by before. But if you look at the pheasant stamp, it says that except as provided or section 97A, well, whatever, a person required to possess a small game license may not hunt pheasants without a pheasant stamp. So thereby, since they don't need a small game license, they don't need a pheasant stamp either. And I just wanted to clarify that as long as they're hunting on their own farm. But it's one of those things, like I said, one of those nuances in the game and fish laws that I had forgotten about.
All right. Thank you for the clarification. And we'll try to all remember that. Thank you, members. We'll see you at 6 o'clock.
We're all just so used to
meeting's adjourned.